Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Practical Perspectives. Today we talk about the management of advanced gastroesophageal cancers. We're so happy today to have as our faculty Dr. Yelena Janjigian from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. Today we're talking about the very fast-moving world of gastroesophageal cancers. And, you know, Yelena, I don't know, we have this thing that whenever we do a webinar, I can always be sure that, like, within a couple of days before we get started, we're going to see some press release. And lo and behold, that's what happened again. So we're going to talk about that in a second. This could be a world shaker, but definitely going to be a lot of interesting discussion, I think, at the ASCO GI meeting coming up in beginning of the year. As always, we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and regimens today. So check out the full prescribing information of each product for more. So today, as we've been doing since the beginning of the pandemic now, I think we've presented more than 5,000 cases from community-based general medical oncologists. We have 7 cases today from these docs. We really appreciate so much that they sit down with me and ask the questions they want to get into. So we're going to intersperse these 7 cases with some reviews of data. We're going to start out talking about, originally we weren't going to talk about HER2 first, but when I saw this press release yesterday, I was like, okay, I think we're going to need to talk about HER2. Before we get into the press release, so Yelena, just a little bit of, by way of background, what our audience has been hearing about HER2 targeted therapy. I put up there kind of the sequence of approvals of HER2 agents, and I put in there ATWT. I don't know whether our audience is familiar with that abbreviation, but for some reason, when I was putting this slide together, and you can put this into Google, actually, it'll tell you it stands for the soap opera As the World Turns. I was thinking this is as HER2 turns and some interesting twists along the way, including what happened yesterday. So breast cancer things kind of started out sort of, you know, quietly and really spectacularly, actually, in the 90s, the first monoclonal antibody, trastuzumab, approved in 1998. We saw lapatinib, pertuzumab, then ADCs, T-DM1, particularly in the post-neoadjuvant setting. And now, of course, we had T-DXd come along, have a huge impact. And now, as of ESMO, we saw data looking at neoadjuvant and post-neoadjuvant T-DXd, and we just saw first-line therapy of metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer at ASCO TDXD. Lung cancer has been kind of interesting in terms of HER2 because they see more HER2 mutations. And just in the last few months, it's become apparent that a lot of these mutants are so-called TKD mutants. And we now have a drug, a TKI, zongertinib, approved. And when you look at the way patients respond, a waterfall plot, it looks a lot like ALK and EGFR. These are activating mutations that respond well. This TKI, there's another one coming along. Colorectal cancer, we've seen tucatinib, trastuzumab, TDXD. Here in GI cancers, of course, we started out with trastuzumab. We'll talk about Yelena's 811 study looking at trastuzumab chemo and pembrolizumab. TDXD, we saw second-line therapy at ASCO. And then sort of coming along, too, was biliary tract cancers. They hopped on the HER3 multi-tumor or non-tumor specific bandwagon for TDXD. But interestingly, they also have a bispecific zanidatamab, which was first approved in biliary tract cancer, not the most common cancer that we see. So here's the picture as of yesterday. And then we see this press release that there's now phase 3 randomized study, the HERIZON GEA-01 trial, again, hopefully going to be presented at the ASCO GI meeting, looking at this bispecific in the first-line setting with chemotherapy with or without the PD-1 inhibitor tislelizumab, one we don't use very often. And, of course, if Yelena knows any of the results, she's not going to be able to talk about it right now. But I would like you to try to get us ready for this. We'll take a look at some of the Zani data later. We're going to go through the 811 data after we see a couple of cases. But can you just sort of get us ready to see this presentation and what we ought to be looking for, particularly as it relates to the design of the study?
Sure, of course. Well, we're eagerly awaiting the study. And as you mentioned, it's for patients with HER2 IHC3+ or IHC2+. FISH positive untreated gastric and esophageal and G junction adenocarcinoma. patients are enrolled irrespective of PD-L1 status, and it's a important study because we're looking at biparatopics, zanidatamab in combination with standard chemotherapy, which is fluoropyrimidine platinum, with or without tislelizumab. It's a one-to-one randomization, but as you see here, the comparator arm is trastuzumab plus chemotherapy, which is capecitabine oxaliplatin, without the anti-PD-1 combination with pembrolizumab. So because the study was designed and started to sort of be planned before KEYNOTE-811 regimen was fully available. So in order to plan the study, calculate the sample size and power of it, they really needed to see the KEYNOTE-811, but it wasn't yet available, so they designed it without it. Unfortunately, most of the centers in the United States didn't even participate in the study because of the difficulty of the randomization without, United States patients don't like to be randomized to begin with. And here, if you randomize them to non-IO containing arm in the age where we know anti-HER2 therapy with in combination with anti-PD-1 is important. So that's going to be the biggest challenge because there is an IO arm, Zani plus Tisley, which is, as you mentioned, the B1 anti-PD-L1 drug. But it's not, there's no TRAS-PEMBRO-TRAS-TISLEY arm, which is going to be a little bit tricky for clinicians and even specialists like me to sort through the data because this study is really designed to answer contribution of components. Does dual HER2 inhibition with Zani add something above TRAS? And we think it will. And then, of course, we suspect that Zani plus Tisley and chemo will do better than TRAS chemo. And then somewhere in between, we need to decide the contribution of components of anti-PD-1 with HER2, as we know is synergistic in, with trastuzumab. Here we need to look at tislelizumab, which I suspect will perform similar to pembrolizumab, but you never know. And then zanidatamab. Of course, the big issue with biparatopics such as zanidatamab is the high risk of diarrhea that's associated with this drug, particularly, as you can imagine, when you combine it with fluoropyrimidine, and particularly oral fluoropyrimidine here, capecitabine. We have to see. We had experience with this drug in phase 2, as I mentioned, before it went to phase 3, with use of FOLFOX. It was doable, but still grade 3-4 diarrhea was a big hurdle. I mean, close to 40%+ of patients had it. Now I think the investigators for sure and even the company became aware of that and used more prophylactic regimens and drugs like loperamide and other drugs in the phase 3. So hopefully that will make this management doable. Neil, as always, our patients, GI patients, are motivated. The GI doctors are willing to put up with toxicity. Show us the efficacy, and then we'll decide, basically.
So it sounds like we're going to be in a very common situation in oncology where we're going to have to make indirect comparisons here when the data is finally presented. Of course, as you mentioned, the efficacy is going to be a key thing we'll be looking at, but also tolerability. Just kind of curious, we've in terms of HER2 and diarrhea, pertuzumab, we've seen diarrhea with. Also neratinib, the TKI, a lot of diarrhea, which again was able to be prevented to a great extent. What do you think's going on here in terms of that? Do you think that it's hitting the same receptor as pertuzumab and that's what's causing it?
Yeah, well, I mean, HER2 is an important receptor in a 4-receptor superfamily. GFR is included in there too. So I think with that dimerization and other factors, and also the effect of this drug on the epithelium and colon epithelium, once it starts the process, it's hard to turn it around. So I think the key will be compliance with prophylaxis for patients, starting anti-diarrheal agents before the drugs go in. And also, of course, when diarrhea sets in is the chemotherapy delivery. We know the studies where the backbone of the chemotherapy, is not, we're not able to deliver it, often long-term efficacy suffers and the survival curves may separate and then converge together. So all of those factors we will be looking for as we're dissecting the data, and it will be at ASCO GI.
All right, so we're going to move on now and talk about several cases. We have a bunch of data slides in the slide deck for you to check out. We are not going to discuss most of them today. I want to emphasize now what we're doing today, particularly as it relates to the use of T-DXd and the data we saw at ASCO. So we're going to start out with a case from Dr. Iannucci, a 60-year-old man who really fits into the 8-11 mode. Here's Dr. Iannucci.
60-year-old gentleman, history of Barrett's esophagus and peptic ulcer disease, also stage 4 esophageal adenocarcinoma. His disease is HER2-positive, PD-L1, TPS3. He presented with hematemesis, melena, weight loss. Initial staging PET scan, unfortunately, revealed diffuse metastatic disease. And so we discussed that this treatment is palliative. He's got grandchildren. He's a mechanic. He did not want to be hooked up to a pump, if that was at all possible. But he wanted to live as long as he could for his grandchildren. And so we decided to be fairly aggressive up front with a regimen of capecitabine, oxaliplatin, trastuzumab, and pembrolizumab. So far, he's tolerating the regimen well. I've seen him back once. No immunotherapy-related side effects. And despite all of his comorbidities, he is tolerating it fairly well.
Any questions about his case?
Yes. What would be their recommendations for second-line therapy upon progression? And that, it would probably be something like T-DXd.
So any comments about this initial management and also her question? I see the CPS was 3 there. Any comments about the initial treatment there with the Adalegin regimen and then how you think through second line?
It's great to hear that the patient is doing well, and this is a well-tolerated regimen, and that's most of our patients are able to get through the treatment without major side effects. But of course, dose-reducing oxaliplatin and capecitabine is also the way to improve on tolerance and continue to the treatment. We plan usually for at least 6 months of oxali and then continuing capecitabine with pembro or tras. I still have patients on who were on KEYNOTE-811s that are disease-free or with long-term survival without progression. It's interesting because the pattern of progression for this regimen, what we've noticed both from our initial phase 2, but also now in standard practice and from phase 3, you often have these escape lesions new lesions as opposed to prior target lesions that are growing. And I think that highlights the heterogeneity of HER2 in our disease. So if feasible, whether or not it's the primary tumor that's progressing or another new lesion that's progressing, at the time of progression, it's very important to consider doing a biopsy. And the FDA, actually, package insert for T-DXd recommends that for our disease. So you could do either a liquid biopsy using circulating tumor DNA, but that may not show HER2, so I wouldn't necessarily use that solely. And often, if feasible, we re-biopsy the tumors that are progressing. And if the tumor is still HER2 positive, T-DXd would be a great option. My preference is to use T-DXd as early in the disease. Of course, in the United States, you could use it in second line or third line. Most patients, I prefer to use it in second line because of this, certainly patients over time may become less functional and have more side effects from, T-DXd. But yes, T-DXd would be a good option. Typically, we start at 6.4 mg per kg, which is slightly higher dose. But again, I think the tolerance, especially in a frailer patient, perhaps, starting with 5.4 or even, 4.4 dose would be appropriate in this patient population. And the efficacy, I think is clear now by a definitive DG04 study, DESTINY-Gastric04, that showed that it clearly is better than standard of care paclitaxel ramucirumab, which is what you would do otherwise.
So we'll take a look at some of that data in a second, but let me just put in another case here. This is from Dr. Morgenstein, a 62-year-old man with the recurrent multi-regimen treated HER2-positive GEJ adenocarcinoma, also Claudin-18-positive, PD-L1 of 0. Here's Dr. Morgenstein.
He was then placed on TDXD. He didn't tolerate it great with significant side effects of fatigue and nausea, and unfortunately progressed, and he just started this week on 5-FU and zolbetuximab in the later line of therapy. So I guess the question is, what is the role of zolbetuximab in people who have Claudin 18.2 positive as well as HER2 positivity? How should we sequence these medicines? Is it okay to give zolbetuximab in later lines of therapy like we've done on this gentleman?
I see he just started on zolbetuximab. How did he do in terms of nausea and vomiting?
He had minimal. We were also super duper cautious. He got every single thing under the books. We slowed the infusion rate as per our pharmacist and nurses, hydrated him, and he did okay with it.
Any questions for the faculty?
We now have bispecific antibodies, zanidatamab, and hepatobiliary cancers. Is there any role for that in later lines of therapy, either single agent or with chemotherapy in HER2-positive gastric or GE junction cancer? Again, my first patient, zanidatamab, yesterday. Any side effects that we should be looking at? Does it have the classic side effects that some of our other bispecific antibodies may have in other tumor types?
Any other questions?
In this patient who's been through numerous HER2-directed therapies, is there any other role for the TKIs that we're using in breast cancer, either neratinib or tucatinib?
So I guess he, I don't know how to premonition that this press release is going to come out. he told me he actually gave Zanny to a patient with GE cancer that ran out of options. I don't know how he got it. But anyway, let's get back to more what's happening nowadays. Let's talk a little bit about, you were mentioning it, TDXD is your usual second-line therapy. We'll talk about the fact they're first-line trials, but let's just take a look. Here's gastric 03 that kind of preceded gastric 04 that was presented at ASCO. Anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, so the 03 study, so there was gastric 01 that was in Asia in third line that was positive against investigators' choice of chemotherapy. FDA approved TDXT in the United States just based on that study because the data was so impressive. Then we did a DG02 study, which was a single-arm phase 2 in the United States and Europe, that basically confirmed that in second line there is activity. DG03 is the first-line study. So my interest was to bring TDXT to first-line, so I designed this study of TDXT plus fluoropyrimidine, so capecitabine, and immunotherapy, pembrolizumab, to bring it to first line. So DG03 is in first line. The data looks promising. We're actually already open two phase 3 studies based on this data. As you see here, it's a nice waterfall, and the survival curves look pretty good too. But, you know, it's not practice-changing. DG04 is the practice-changing study that I was quoting, which looked at randomized phase 3 data that looked at TDXT with Taxol versus Taxol RAM. So I think the strongest evidence in second line, before this, no one's been able to demonstrate any benefit above Taxol RAM for any drugs. So DESTINY-04 broke that barrier, and we can definitively say that TDXT has, you know, activity, response, survival against chemo and anti-VEGF. HER2 is the level 1 biomarker. I think even in metastatic first-line setting, when I give a biomarker talk, I tell, whoever listens to prioritize biomarkers in first-line setting based on microsatellite instability. HER2 is the second priority based on efficacy and survival and response. PD-L1 is the third. And even in first-line setting in combination with chemo, Claudin is the fourth. And why do we prioritize Claudin but less so than HER2 or MSI or high PD-L1? Is because zolbetuximab does not have single agent activity, never caused the response rate by itself, but also does not improve response rate even in combination with standard doublet chemotherapy. So it helps stabilize the cancer and maybe prolong some disease stabilization and survival, but does not shrink the cancer. And unlike trastuzumab or T-DXd, where there is some anti, you know, single agent activity, there's no such activity. And so if you're thinking of what should I give a patient in second line, Zolbe versus T-DXd, first of all, Zolbe wouldn't be my choice because it doesn't have any activity in HER2-positive disease that we know of, especially in second line. T-DXd would definitely be the preferred option. And again, just as you were careful with Zolbe, you know, in terms of antiemetics, et cetera, people forget that T-DXd is chemo, and it's pretty powerful chemo. So you got to do dose reductions. You got to do nausea-vomiting regimen. Some patients may require delayed emesis regimen, you know, olanzapine, decadron, all of those good medications that we usually use with high emetogenic potential medications. In terms of zanidatamab, that's an interesting question. Zani actually does have single agent activity if you look at early phase one data, again, in HER2 positive disease, because HER2 is a very good biomarker. I wouldn't put claudin and HER2 on the same link. You know, claudin is one of those biomarkers that we know is overexpressed at low level and maybe some high level in tumors throughout, right? So it is important, but we don't think it's a driver of biology the same way that HER2 is. And I think zanidatamab is interesting. You know, would I use it, and is there activity in T-DXd refractory cases? That's TBD, because a lot of the early zani data was before T-DXd was used in the clinic. But certainly, you know, would be interesting to try. It's impressive, you know, how many off-label options this physician colleague was able to offer to his patient. And I think, you know, it's not unreasonable to try it, but I think T-DXd, because of the anti-HER2 and the chemotherapy payload, has been what we succeeded with in the clinic and in the phase three level one evidence, because gastric cancer is heterogeneous. So even if zanidatamab might work by itself on a subset of HER2 positive clones that you see in your tumor, you have to remember that just as many clones may have HER2 low or negative expression, and those patients, you know, patients may not derive as deep of a response or benefit.
So I always love working with people from Memorial and hearing the sirens and all in the background, a little New York City audio there in the background. So a couple people in the chat room picked up on your comment, as we always hear from GI investigators about wanting to re-biopsy. You just talked about that. Here's the phase three DESTINY-Gastric05, both in PD-1 positive and negative patients. We'll see whether gastroesophageal cancer is going to follow breast cancer and end up with T-DXd as first line. Just one other question about T-DXd, and we kind of went through the toxicity data with the ASCO presentation. But what are you doing for practical purposes? What do you advise people in terms of screening for ILD? In breast cancer, they're very aggressive. Asymptomatic patients are getting scanned every 9 weeks. How do you approach it in gastroesophageal cancer?
We don't see as much, you know, our grade three toxicity is in low, you know, single or high single or low double digits. So it's less, it's 10% or less, 7%, depending on the study. And we scan our patients every 9 to 12 weeks already for regular tumor assessment. So we don't scan any additional number of scans or asymptomatic patients. I think it's just very important to look at the entire scan, read the fine print of the whole body of the read, not just the impression where it says, you know, response to therapy. Every GGO, every kind of lung inflammation that's asymptomatic, you have to kind of carefully go through. And if you have grade one, you know, or even maybe just asymptomatic finding on the lung exam, be careful and maybe hold or interrupt the drugs. And typically, you know, unlike breast cancer, our patients, just the median number of cycles is smaller, and their exposure to other anti-HER2 therapies or even breast or, you know, chest wall radiation or other factors, you know, may reduce the chances of ILD in our patients.
So for all the people in the chat room asking about the Matterhorn study, we're getting there. We'll be there in a minute. So that's our value map flight. Everybody wants to know about. Of course, we saw more data at ESMO. We're not going to talk about the Rivli Ghostamig, really another fascinating bispecific now, a PD-1 and TIGIT targeting or trials looking at whether or not that's going to be added into an increasingly complicated mix. We already talked about zanidatamab and what had been seen previously looking at zani with a chemotherapy. And again, we talked about the phase 3 trial that's coming about that we'll see soon. Tucatinib sounds like it's kind of maybe not going to end up being going very far. There's also a bispecific, another bispecific HER2, and binitumab that's, I think, been used in China. Again, we'll see. It looks like interesting initial data. We'll see whether that ends up working into the HER2 algorithm. And then finally, as we're going to talk about in terms of the FLOT regimen, in terms of neoadjuvant IO, we saw some data at ESMO looking at pembro and trastuzumab with FLOT. We always get people asking about this. And we'll get into this when we get to Matterhorn, because this was a very interesting study. But I want to move on now and get to our second topic, which is MSI high gastroesophageal cancer. In a second, I'm going to let you hear a case from Dr. Mulhern from the Aon Group. Actually, this is a patient with metastatic disease. We presented another patient of his about 10 days ago at the Aon meeting. Where your colleague down the road there in New York, Dr. Shah, discussed another case with Dr. Mulhern of a patient with localized MSI-high disease. Interestingly, he was unable to get an IO for the patient, ended up giving the patient FLOT, very frustrated the insurance company wouldn't pay for an IO. But the case you're going to hear about now is a patient with metastatic disease. Here's Dr. Mulhern. All right, 82-year-old woman.
So this person, she has a little bit of dementia. She had some dysphagia, 10-pound weight loss. She had some abdominal pain, ultimately had an EGD showing this GE junction mass, and she had adenocarcinoma. And by the time she was diagnosed, she had numerous liver and lung mets. She's PD-L1 positive, but kind of unexpectedly, she's DMMR. She actually has a history of colon cancer 30 years ago. And from what we can tell, it was probably a stage 2. So Would you consider treating her with immunotherapy alone? So that's what we decided to do. We said, you know, she's not really a great candidate even for something like, you know, FOLFOX or even just 5-FU. With the dementia, I'd be worried about like the capecitabine. She has close monitoring by her family, but she's got dysphagia. So it'd be 5-FU and not capecitabine. But I think it'd make more sense just to give her immunotherapy and see how she does. So that's what we did. This one, we didn't have any problems getting through insurance. She had Medicare as a primary insurer. Is there a point where even not just based on toxicity, you'd consider just using PD-L1 just by itself, especially based on that MMR? She's treatment naive, but it seemed like the right thing to do for her. So she's been on that for 3-4 months now and seems to be responding. She's improved. Even her mental status seems to have improved a little bit. I think she was depressed and she'd lost weight, and you know, people with dementia that can affect that too, that seems to have improved a little bit. So far she seems to be tolerating it well and responding and improving.
So well, any thoughts about this about case that. Of medicine? No, I was just going to say, I'd also like to hear not only what your thoughts are about this case, but also the localized case that he had, localized MSI-high disease. Again, would you think about immunotherapy or immunotherapy alone? What type of immunotherapy? So tell us a little bit about your thoughts. We'll show some of the data that we've seen here with MSI-high GI cancers, including this from the ASCO 24 meeting looking at nivolumab. But can you just talk about how you think through the data and how you would like to be able and how you do manage these patients?
Sure. You know, I think an early stage disease combination of either dual immune checkpoint blockade with durva-tremi, so durvalumab, tremelimumab, or nivo-ipi would be, this is all part of NCCN guidelines, or chemoimmunotherapy, or anti-PD-1 alone. I think those are all good options. What I do practically, we usually do either chemoimmunotherapy or dual immune checkpoint blockade in early stage disease. Or if it's a really early stage cancer and it's, you know, feasible to do an endoscopic mucosal resection, that would be another option. In a patient like this that was presented with, you know, advanced stage 4 disease but sort of borderline, dementia and maybe functional status, you know, I think doing single-agent therapy would be definitely appropriate. I would be maybe a little tempted to give one dose of Tremi because, Tremolimumab, you could do single dose probably with the same efficacy as supported by some of the HCC data, but also, the phase two data coming out of Italy for MSI tumors. But I think the approach there was very appropriate, and I'm glad the patient is doing well. I agree with it.
What about, I don't know how often you see, do you think that gastroesophageal MSI high is as responsive to IOs as colorectal? And do you sometimes find yourself in a situation where people are doing well free of disease at 2 years and you stop?
That's a good question. And the short answer is we have a lot less complete responders compared to what you would see in rectal cancer, at least with anti-PD-1 therapy alone. So we know that anti-PD-1 therapy induces complete responses probably in the 60-65% of patients, but not in 100% of patients. And then what to do with those patients? How do you know which patients will not have a complete response? That's the big question. And that's why most of us erred on the side of dual immune checkpoint blockade or chemoimmunotherapy. And yes, in patients with complete response, I think are interested in close monitoring, non-operative options are available. I think stopping therapy at 2 years is very reasonable for metastatic disease. We often use combination with functional imaging, which PET scan, scopes, endoscopy. I just had a patient with stage 4 disease who had a complete response, and they always have some immune-related side effects. In this case, it was rash. He actually required Dupixent therapy that flared even after we stopped immunotherapy. So his immune system is definitely active. But using combination of Signatera and other assays to monitor circulating tumor DNA, I convinced him to stop the immunotherapy after two years, and he's now on just monitoring. But it's difficult for the patients who came in very sick and symptomatic, obstructed, their disease melted away with immunotherapy. They knew they didn't have surgery and they have metastatic disease. So emotionally, to get them off immunotherapy is very difficult for them.
Yeah, that's understandable. All right, so let's move on and talk about neoadjuvant therapy and a much-discussed Matterhorn study. We'll get into it, though, as always. When we go into practice, we always see things we never think about. And here's Dr. Divers talking about a 65-year-old man with localized disease.
He underwent esophagogastrectomy and postoperatively showed residual disease with a T3 lesion that was node negative. He was then placed on adjuvant avelumab and has done amazingly well.
Any questions about this case?
I really selected this case because it's a non-metastatic claudin 18 positive case. We don't really have any neoadjuvant data with that agent, to my knowledge. But I also am super curious, given the data with FLOT, which is now out in the perioperative space, and compared to the cross regimen without nivolumab, would anyone have chosen FLOT?
Any other questions about this case?
When and if we may see some neoadjuvant zolbetuximab data.
So, of course, it's interesting. These people present cases and then things change once they present the case.
Yeah.
But anyhow, this patient, I should have mentioned, got the cross regimen and ended up, as you heard, with residual disease.
Yep.
But, of course, everybody wants to hear about the Matterhorn study, including the data just presented at the ESMO meeting on survival. So can you talk about this study, what the design was and what the findings have been?
Sure. So, of course, it was the big splash at ASCO. We presented in plenary session the results of the phase 3 Matterhorn study, which is a randomized study in patients with gastric and G-junction tumors, adenocarcinomas, irrespective of PD-L1. But patients were stratified using tumor area positivity, which is how we define PD-L1. You could use CPS, TAP. So in this case, it was TAP, which are equivalent measures. And patients were compared to FLOT. So patients got four doses of FLOT, which is two cycles, with one per cycle, one dose of Durva. So four cycles of FLOT, two doses of Durva, surgery, and the same, versus placebo. We saw improvement in pathologic complete response rate. So 19% patients had path CR. And this was the first study that showed that path CR translated to event-free survival and to overall survival. So your data you're looking at now, which we presented at ESMO subsequently, and this was a big deal because there was no study, including CheckMate 577, that showed that DFS or EFS translates to OS. So Matterhorn in neoadjuvant setting was the first study to show that chemo IO is feasible and it improves all major endpoints of efficacy, which is path CR, EFS, and OS. And as you see here, there is a delta at 3 years, 2 years, you know, meaningful landmark improvement. And the difference appears to be, the benefit appears to be irrespective of PD-L1. And as you can expect, the magnitude of benefit is, you know, great for path CR, but also in patients with major pathologic response. And what we see also is dramatically improvement in nodal downstaging. And practically, Neil, we know that chemo and immunotherapy before surgery and treatment in general for this disease before surgery is much better tolerated. We also showed that you can do it globally. These are doctors from South Korea. In fact, at ESMO Asia, I'm presenting the Asian, so Japan, South Korea, Taiwan. Those doctors were willing to give patients FLOT. And they did a pretty good job, actually. So, and the, you know, delivery and completion of FLOT before surgery and after surgery and even up to a year of DERVA was very reasonable, actually better than anyone expected.
So any thoughts in terms of minimizing a FLOT by itself is a challenge, as you just are alluding to. Now we're adding in another agent. Anything you do to try to particularly minimize the toxicity of FLOT? And also, are there situations now, are there any situations where you wouldn't use DERVA plus FLOT? And are there situations where you're deciding between cross and FLOT where now you're going to think more about FLOT because you can do the IO neoadjuvantly?
Yeah, I think if you're near a good surgeon who can get an R0 resection and it feels comfortable operating on gastroesophageal cancer, we know radiation adds nothing to survival. There's been three now studies that showed the radiation does not add to survival in this disease. So if you're radiating the patient, you have to ask yourself why you're doing that. And you're probably doing that because you think it's going to do some sort of improvement in local control. But that comes at a cost of systemic disease control. Study after study, we see that 90% of patients recur systemically. That's why FLOT is the preferred regimen and the more effective regimen. I've not radiated a patient probably in close to 6 years. And I think selecting the patients for surgery is appropriate, not rushing into surgery, right? If you think that the margin will be a challenge, perhaps you shouldn't be operating on this patient. This patient has more advanced disease. And so by radiating and artificially elevating R0, you know, improving R0 resection, you're doing them a disservice because they all recur anyway. FLOT is a learned skill, delivering FLOT, realizing that, you know, you can dose reduce and also use antiemetics and hydrate the patient. I think there's a learning curve. We're seeing that more and more investigators, surgeons, and so forth are getting comfortable with it.
And also, you made an interesting comment. We were talking about this case we presented 10 days ago where Dr. Mulhern was not able to get an IO in the neoadjuvant setting. But you were saying that now that you have the Matterhorn data, you could kind of get it that way as opposed to the MSI way, and still the patient gets the IO.
Yep. Exactly. I mean, you know, the benefit is irrespective of PD-L1. Most patients are PD-L1 positive. NCCN right now is restricting by PD-L1. I think this was before they saw OS data. And in the near future, probably within a few months, we will hopefully have the FDA approval because that's been in the works for some time. So, you know, I think the question that was asked also is what about Zolbi or Claudin strategies in perioperative setting? And absolutely, all of our work that we've done in metastatic setting is now moving into perioperative. You showed the data for HER2 combination. We have our MSK data. There's a German study and then also Chinese study looking at a combination of anti-HER2, anti-PD-1 with FLOT. It's looking very promising. We're also opening a panel, study for HER2-positive patients where we're doing T-DXd perioperative. For claudin-positive patients, we're doing claudin-ADC perioperative. Neoadjuvant claudin inhibitors will be tough because of course, the class effect of nausea. But the adjuvant therapy may be appealing because once you remove the primary tumor, the patient's nausea dissipates. So we would have to see. But I think for claudin overexpressing tumors, HER2 overexpressing tumors, all of these dual biologic anti-PD-1 therapies are moving to the front setting, to neoadjuvant setting.
Yeah, that's a great point about the nausea that you don't really see very much of if they've had their stomach removed. So that's a great point. Okay, a couple more cases. We're going to get into zolbetuximab in a second. A lot of questions about that. But I think this next case is also really interesting. 80-year-old man with metastatic recurrence of adenocarcinoma, PD-L1, TPS of 75%. 2 years after resection of localized disease, kind of an interesting story here. Here's Dr. Apori.
This gentleman was offered endomucosal resection. He was referred to a tertiary center. He underwent the endomucosal resection and was noted to have a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma. 1.5 centimeters, margins are negative, but it was involving the submucosa. He did remarkably well for 2 years, and he did not have any disease recurrence. He was undergoing surveillance endoscopies. There was no evidence of disease. Unfortunately, he presented to the emergency room with nausea and vomiting ongoing for about 1 to 2 weeks. Also noted to have a weight loss of about 25-30 pounds. That led to a repeat endoscopy. And this time around, there is a mass in the gastric cardia, which was 4 centimeters. And the biopsy was consistent with well-differentiated adenocarcinoma. Further testing was performed, and the HER2 IHC was negative, and the PD-L1 was 75%. He also underwent a repeat PET CT scan after the diagnosis and an FDG avid mass involving the stomach with extension into the GE junction was noted along with significant lymphadenopathy involving the mediastinum and the retroperitoneum. He was initiated on FOLFOX with nivolumab. So far, he has completed approximately 3 cycles. He's still struggling with nausea, but at least no more weight loss.
Any questions about his case?
I would like to ask the experts, did we miss anything when we did the endoscopy to begin with? Was there anything that would have been done differently? And the second question is, would they have treated this patient any differently than with the FOLFOX with the nivolumab regimen?
So very curious about the way this case started out with this endomucosal resection, whether that's something you see a lot of people getting. Do you see people recurring? And then maybe you can kind of summarize where we are in terms of IOs and first-line metastatic disease, particularly as it relates to PD-1 level. We're going to show some slides from the trials, but I'd rather you just describe the way you think it through. So first question, what do you think about the beginning of this case? Is that was that case managed according to standards or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's likely a different subpopulation of cells that you resected, and then some cells were already laying dormant in the systemic niche and then decided to grow and I think without re-reviewing all the scans and seeing the burden of disease radiographically, my sense is that, maybe surgery would have operation, if this was signet ring or poorly differentiated diffuse gastric type, often we do see more advanced disease that endoscopic mucosal resections don't reveal. Based on everything you said, if the margin was negative, at the endoscopic mucosal resection, the management was very appropriate.
So what about the issue of IOs and metastatic disease? We saw the FDA coming out in May with this, change to the indication, now PD-1 being one. We all had this debate over the last few years. What about 1 to 5 as opposed to 0? esophageal versus gastroesophageal. Again, without going through all these data, maybe you can just summarize in your own words what we know about this question.
Well, so this is adenocarcinoma. So really what we're looking at is 649 data. CheckMate 649 data is the appropriate study to look at. But also, of course, the pembrolizumab data with KEYNOTE-585 or 859, rather, and also tislelizumab data. The FDA restricted indication using PD-L1 CPS cutoff to make it uniform across the indications, both for nivolumab, pembrolizumab, tislelizumab, because the rationale data had come out restricting by PD-L1. And that's how this restriction came about. We know that PD-L1 positive tumors benefit the greatest. The patient with a PD-L1 positive tumor benefits the greatest. And to my earlier point, how we prioritize these biomarkers in stage four setting, all of the biomarkers are immunohistochemistry, so you could get an answer just using unstained slides. In under 10 slides, you could test all of the important biomarkers, right? MMR, mismatch repair protein deficiency, you could test on 4 slides, and that could be, you know, within the first 3 days of diagnosis, you would know if they're MSI tumors, MMR deficient or not. HER2 using IHC 3+, and if it's 2+, you do FISH, and that's we would prioritize that. PD-L1 using CPS or TAP, and depending on how you interpret the data, you could use CPS-1, which is most people use as a priority, or CPS-5 to use immunotherapy. So if you're in Europe, you know, it's restricted by 5. In the United States, you can use it by 1. In the United States, if you don't use immunotherapy in first line, you cannot use it in later line for MSS tumors. It's not approved. So I am not able to get my patients immunotherapy in second or third line, only in first line. And then for claudin-positive tumors that are HER2-negative and PD-L1-negative or low, claudin inhibitor, zolbetuximab, you know, how we would prioritize in the fourth, as a fourth biomarker. The good news for the first three, it's relatively easy. It's all immunotherapy-based therapies, right? You have to decide what chemo to use and if you want to combine it with chemo or not. For MSI, you may get away without using chemo in first line, although most of us probably would use chemotherapy. So FOLFOX-NEVO for this patient was very appropriate. If the tumor is HER2 positive, you would add anti-HER2 therapy. And for claudin positive right now, there's no data to combine claudin with anti-PD-1, so you would just use FOLFOX with zolbetuximab. So that's how we think about first line. All the biomarkers are immunohistochemistry based, so we don't have to wait for NGS. You know, the newest pain in New York State and New Jersey, and I think probably all over the United States, is we have to start DYPD testing routinely. That's become part of our fluoropyrimidine workflows. So you could use, you know, you have to consent the patient for germline testing, and you know, we use our own internal tests. You can also send tumors blood out for Guardant, which has been a nice way to, because they report all the variants, important variants for DYPD deficiency. But that's kind of, in a nutshell, how we treat gastroesophageal adenocarcinoma in first-line setting.
So I guess a related question, you mentioned the fact that if you're going to give an IO, it's going to need to be in the first line. Last week, we were doing a webinar on small cell, extensive stage small cell cancer of the lung, where they added an IO to chemo. And when you look at the global population, you know, not that impressive of a hazard rate. But what we showed last week, which I'd never seen before, is it looks like there's clearly a 10 or 12% 5-year survival. For the first time in small cell. So it's not great, you know, it's not like 50%, but it's there. Mm-hmm. Do you think then a gastroesophageal cancer, do you see long-term survival that you think might be related to IO?
We do. We presented 5-year, it's actually going to be published in 5-year OS from CheckMate 649. So approximately, you know, 15 to 20% of patients have 5-year survivals. And this is not just people, you know, that are in tertiary cancer centers, that are highly resourced and so forth. This is global phase 3 study. And so in tertiary cancer centers where there's more likely patients to receive second and third line therapy and have specialized care, the survivals, I mean, I have people living years with this disease now.
Interesting. So just a couple more things. I'm curious, you can say whether it's relevant or not. At ASCO, we saw more of the phase 3 LEAP study looking at lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. Curious whether you think there's any future there in gastroesophageal cancer. Also, So I was going to throw in a couple other questions too. So ifinatamab deruxtecan, another ADC with a different target. We saw a press release there suggesting activity. Also, another TROP2 ADC, I guess coming out of Asia. We've talked a lot about this in our breast cancer programs, but sac-TMT. We have the TROPFUSE data that was presented last year at ESMO. Any thoughts about any of these, sac-TMT, the ADC, ifinatamab, as well as lenvatinib pembro?
So the ifinatamab data is in squamous more, and that's still mostly Asia, and so we would need to see more data to know. I mean, there's been a lot of work done in China and other places where you'd see it, they present it, and then you just move on because we need more confirmatory data. The VEGF story is interesting. In first-line setting in gastroesophageal cancer, we have not been able to break the VEGF barrier. But we know preliminary data from our biomarker work from CheckMate 649 shows that low angiogenesis signatures predict better outcomes with chemoimmunotherapy. So it makes sense to inhibit angiogenesis and work on that combination. Unfortunately, as you know, regorafenib failed in later lines for gastroesophageal, so it's not being moved up into first line. Regonivo data was negative. This was presented at ESMO. And Lenva data with pembro and chemo was flat out disappointing in first line. But where we are moving toward, and now there's, you know, at least 3 phase 3 studies that I counted recently, looking at bispecifics of PD-1 VEGF antibodies, bispecifics targeting in combination with chemo. So BMS is doing a study, Pfizer is doing a study, and there's, you know, of course, data in lung cancer to support that approach. So tumor microenvironment is important. We think VEGF is obviously important in gastroesophageal cancer, but it has not entered first line, and lenvatinib and rego data is dead. The TROP2 data looks very interesting in bladder, especially in combination with anti-PD-1 for various TROP2 ADCs that we have through AstraZeneca. Unfortunately, so far, the TROP2 data that we've seen in gastroesophageal cancer is not yet going to be prime time and is relatively disappointing.
So one more case, and you can imagine I'm starting to hear cases from docs in practice of patients getting zolbetuximab, some pretty challenging stories. We presented one at that Aon meeting I was talking about of a patient with really difficult problems. But here I heard something different. I'm curious whether you've seen anything like this, a little bit different description. This is a 74-year-old man, claudin-positive, metastatic esophageal adenocarcinoma, who got FOLFOX zolbetuximab.
Unfortunately, he had really bad infusion reactions 2 times. He had high blood pressure, hot sensation, abdominal pain, low temperatures, cough, saliva palpitations. The nurses were like getting ready to send him to the ER. He had that the first time. We gave him pretty aggressive pre-medications the second time. He had just as bad issues the second time as well. So unfortunately, after the 2 cycles, we held off on further zolbetuximab and just did sort of the standard course of FOLFOX. My question is, how do you guys manage these acute infusional reactions that we see? And then other toxicities down the road, we think of pretty significant, you know, GI symptoms, abdominal pain, nausea, diarrhea. And just sort of curious what your approach is to managing these toxicities, because we definitely want to, you know, get the most out of these therapies when we can. And then do we ever consider, if someone has, you know, a really great response and, you know, very little disease after the chemo, do we ever consider HIPEC for gastric cancer? Is something ever you discuss with patients who've had a great response to therapy?
I'm curious to hear a little bit more about the exact type of infusion reaction he had.
He's a pretty, you know, hardy patient, but he had, you know, this like, abdominal discomfort, palpitations, hypertension. And I was not convinced that was even the one causing the issues. But then when we held it for the third cycle, he did fine. So just sort of by it.
Huh.
Yeah. So it was
No nausea and vomiting, though.
No, it was more just like a flushing abdominal pain, like a classic infusion reaction than what we read about as far as the side effects of the zolbetuximab.
So I saw you shaking your head. Have you seen this?
We did. And I don't think it's like hypersensitivity reaction the way that you would think of hypersensitivity reaction to some of the other monoclonal antibodies. We've seen this with Zolbi, but also other antibodies against claudin. It is really, I think, on target effect of the antibody, and then it's the patient's own sort of, you know, system reacting to these maybe, you know, almost like spasmodic, like discomfort, and then the salivation, all of that is related. I've had a patient like this, just like this, with claudin antibody. There's not much to do. I mean, my patient, we've tried to re-challenge and, with flow infusion, et cetera. But at some point, you know, these benefits of these drugs are relatively incremental. And to spend, you know, your entire day or 2 days over a period of every other week in the clinic just to get them, my patient elected to stop. And, you know, of course, most, I think, docs in the practice just don't have the capabilities or the luxury of spending so much chair time. And so I think for that exact reason, because of the strong data with FOLFOX-NEVO, if the tumor has PD-L1 overexpression, that's been the preference from at least the clinicians that I spoke to that treat gastroesophageal cancer.
So we showed some of the data from the zolbetuximab, the two studies there. Would you ever give IO or Nevo plus zolbetuximab? And are you recommending zolbetuximab if their CPS is zero? Are you using zolbetuximab?
We have used CPS zero patients Zolbi, but it's not a common problem. Most patients have PD-L1 overexpression in the tumor. Of course, Zolbi combination with anti-PD-1 is very tempting because of the immune effects that zolbetuximab has, at least preclinically. But I have used it. Actually, I used it in a private patient that moved to see me. He's a really young patient who moved from China to be my patient and had high-risk disease, had surgery already. As you know, in Asia, many surgeons still manage the disease. So he had primary surgery for and had node positive disease, 24-year-old, and he said, I don't want a surgeon giving me treatment. I'm going to move and get this care with this doctor in the United States. So he moved to see me, high claudin and high PD-L1 overexpression, and a self-pay patient where we didn't have to be worried about coverage. And he tolerated Zolbi, Nevo, FOLFOX very well. It's probably was one of the highest claudin, highest PD-L1 cases that I've seen. And as I mentioned, his tolerance was great because his stomach was removed. So it was a win-win. And it's, things like that, that it was well tolerated. We have the combination anti-PD-1 and claudin data from other monoclonal antibodies, TST-101, for example. We presented some of that data. So I think safety shouldn't be an issue, but unless it is obviously, it's too soon to say. We need larger phase 3 data.
So I'll squeeze in two quick final questions. One, his question about HIPEC and gastroesophageal cancers. And also, I'm just going to call this SV because I can't pronounce it, but anti-claudin ADC.
They call it SANI-V, PRESRIL-V. So rilvegostomig and SANI-V are currently actually in perioperative setting. I already have a trial opening up. So AZD-901 was the drug, and it came from China. The phase 2 data looked really promising. So far, it's so good, but it's, too soon to say. But it is a chemotherapy ADC, so it's very promising, and we're combining it as usual with anti-PD-1 and fluoropyrimidine, so stay tuned. HIPAC patients love the idea. None of the studies so far definitively showed benefit, so I don't routinely do it, but there is a stopgap study that's opening. It's a national study that, you know, may be helpful. I don't find, you know, heating chemo and putting it in the peritoneum if it's not working systemically that helpful. And if the treatment is working systemically, we have patients who have cleared peritoneal disease. I would just continue on that therapy and not stop and operate on the patient, because most of the time they recur. All of the patients so far in my practice, the way we've tried that, and recur, except then they're frail and they can't tolerate additional therapy.
So, Yelena, thank you so much for working with us today. As always, it's always great to work with you. Audience, thank you for attending. Special thanks to the docs who presented cases today. We appreciate this so much. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Yelena. Have a great night.
Bye. Thank you so much.